He doesn't have an appearance filed in this matter. It's just you.
I'm going to talk to him about it, so he was supposed to.
Yeah, there's a time limitation on this, so it's just you. So I would think you might want to go forward on this. This is.
I mean, I cannot go forward with it. He's not handling this. He's representing me.
No, but he is not. There's no appearance in the file. He would have had to file a written appearance.
Right. But he was supposed to do all of that.
He didn't. So it's just you, sir.
Well, I cannot move forward because he's not representing me.
So we can't reschedule it because you're on a deadline here. So I think you might want to listen to the hearing, and then if you want to say anything, you're welcome to add your...
I'm not going to be a part of it. Like I said, my attorney is taking care of it.
Okay. Attorney Murphy.
Yes. The only thing I can suggest, Mr. Meyer, is that the commission needs to move forward with this. This is the general counsel for the commission, and should you wish to do so, you can have your attorney afterward file an appearance, and if appropriate, you can seek to reopen it if you're dissatisfied. That's the only option we have for you at this moment. There's no appearance on file from the lawyer, so we're left with...
We should have been there with something, so I don't know. That happened.
This is just a request for records from the police department in Middletown, sir. This is your request.
Yeah, but I talked to him about it, but he was supposed to follow up on the river.
Okay.
He told me he got it.
This was where your indigency was based on $5 in your account during a 90-day period. So you sure you don't want to be heard?
Like I said, he's representing me.
Okay. All right. His appearance is not in the file, so it would be just you that is representing yourself. I understand you think he's... Okay, we're going to act on it, though, just so you know. All right. So is there anyone here from the city of Middletown? Yes,
Commissioner Farish, I just had a concern to raise. It seems that this policy of $5 seemed very unjust to me, very outdated. And if he makes $14 every 2 weeks, he's only making $365 a year. The federal poverty line is $15,000 a year. It just seems like this policy is hopelessly out of date, and I didn't know if we could do anything about that, ask for the city of Middletown to waive the fee. I don't know if that's done. Just wanted to raise that question.
This is Owen Egan. I had the exact same question. I think $5 is a ridiculously low amount. You can barely buy a cup of coffee with $5 now a day. So, and bare minimum would be $20, in my opinion. But I'm not going to set that rate. I just think that's unfair to this gentleman that he was prohibited from getting these records. He is indigent. It's $14 a week that he makes. He'll never be labeled as indigent because of this policy that Middletown has adopted. I know that the Department of Corrections has the same policy, but I think $5 is a ridiculously low amount. One of the ways I thought that we might be able to deal with it, maybe Attorney Murphy can help us, is could we ask that the city of Middletown start to distribute documents to him on a rolling basis, taking $5 a clip, and then they can deal with sending him 10 records every week or every month, whatever. I mean, I think that would be a difficult task for them, but if that's the policy, then I don't think this man should be prohibited from getting his records.
Well, that might be a good way to do it. I don't think that we can really do that in this case based upon this report. You've got a dismissal based upon approval of that policy. Now, the policy has been authorized by the commission since, I'm going to estimate, 2007, somewhere around there. So the court had told us in a decision that our only role in this is to decide whether agencies can have their own indigence policy, and it just has to be objective, fair, and reasonable, and not applied in a non-discriminatory manner, as it says in paragraph 20 So back then, that is what the commission found. It may be something I would recommend that in, you know, future cases, perhaps, we take a look at that and kind of look at it under today's standards particularly. But right now, we're in a position where the respondents have relied on that policy and the many prior decisions of the commission upholding it. So I wouldn't advocate for that approach, but I certainly, in this case, but I appreciate where Commissioner Parrish and you, Chairman Egan, are going on that. I don't know if the hearing officer has anything else she might like to.
This is Commissioner Hankins. I take a contrary view. In this particular case, the gentleman has his necessaries met by the state of Connecticut. His food, his, you know, where he can stay, although he's not to his choosing. But, you know, he gets his food and everything else taken care of. The other thing is, you know, is that he has an attorney and doing a habeas, and I don't, it's probably from the public defender's office, and the that attorney probably could have had that those documents paid for through some public defender account. So, you know, while it seems $5 or whatever, that the policy seems, you know, draconian, it is the policy, and it's been in effect for a while, and it's part of the law. And I don't think it's up to us to change the law.
I disagree. I think $5 is not fair. And I think if the law says it has to be fair, $5 is not fair. It's too low. Maybe back in 2007 when the law was implemented, it was fair, but it's no longer fair.
But why can't we just take a position today? I mean, there's no reason why it has to continue, I think. If we just delete paragraph 20 and not make that finding and not dismiss the complaint, at least we've started a position that we can continue into the future.
I would not recommend doing that, because that's certainly a clean approach, but I think you would need to go in and explain your reasoning more thoroughly, and you'd like to see us do that if that's the desire of the commission, that we do that in a more reasoned approach and one that will stand up on appeal, because we will be changing course after a long time, and we should explain why we take that change.
So why don't we do that? Then I'd be happy to serve on a task force or whatever you need, committee to look at into the indigency policy. Investigate at least and make recommendations as to what is fair or should be fair.
If that's something the commission wants to do, we can certainly explore that. This, you're not recommending in the confines of this case, though.
I see. Okay. Right? Yeah.
Chairman Egan, so yes. I agree with the concept that everyone seems to be feeling that this is just the number of series are so low for our time. But I think the critical paragraph here from my concern is the reference back to paragraph 19 here, which is the Department of Corrections standard and that was upheld by this commission as late as 2023. So it seems to me a critical place for to dig into this question is when there's a Department of Corrections case. And we are in a position to address the fairness of their policy, better understanding at that point what other issues this indigency standard is applied to besides FOI issues, and better understanding what the rolling nature of it all is. But so I would tend not, while I agree with the goal in terms of strategy, I would think because of the information I see here in paragraph 19 and the key person agency with which we see this question arise time and time again is the Department of Corrections. I would say that would be a good context to take a deeper look at this issue. Otherwise, we have to, why was that okay? That's it. So, but I'm in full sympathy with finding the right way to do it.
That's all. That point.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes, please. Thank you, Commissioner Streeter here. I think the two paragraphs that it sort of hinged on is 11 and 12, where the complainant requested it and indicated that he would have his attorney pay the cost. So they gave him a you know, estimate of, you know, $438.85. I don't know if that figures out to 50 cents a page or whatever, so it's like 800 something pages, but it sounds like that, you know, they only provided the amount because they said they would pay for it. And I just to go with what the other commissioner is saying, if there is some committee that talks about it, maybe there is another fund or something that, you know, people that are considered indigent under either the DOC policy or the particular other policies, that there's some funding mechanism that can help pay for these. It seems like there's a lot of documents, and then if his attorney is involved, that perhaps there's a way that they can get that. But I think for this case in particular, you know, it you know, stands on the point that of prior, you know, precedents that he's not allowed to have these documents under the indigency policy, and that the hearing officer found correctly that it should be dismissed.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Commissioner Gansman?
Yes.
Just
Commissioner Gansman.
We've said quite a bit about it, and everybody has a correct or look at this case. But I go along with what Colleen had said. I don't think this is the spot to do it in. Also, you know, we're talking about Department of Corrections, and that's been going on for a while. I think opening up this matter here and trying to fix it on this case might not be the right road, but maybe having a task force looking into these things another time, but that's just how I see it.
Did the hearing officer want to say anything?
Mary P. Smith, for the record, I was the hearing officer in this matter. You know, I was following the precedent. It's clear. Right. So that's, and it was, like was said, as late as, or as just as recently as 2023, we've upheld this policy. And he is an inmate, so that does mean, they make a distinction between inmates and regular people. I shouldn't say that. And non-inmates, because inmates, their housing, their food, and everything is provided for. So their standard for indigency is lower than a person who's not an inmate. And I think, yeah, in this case, you know, not only the DOC, but other municipalities have adopted the DOC policy, so that's what they're relying on. So it may not be the good place to make that change so abruptly. And I know that because these are police records, there are some exemptions that likely would be mandatory, that could be involved in some of the, you know, some redactions that need to be made.
Thank you. Anyone else? Anything further?
No, I had a question.
Yes.
Commissioner Farish, for Attorney Smith, did you consider at all whether this, it sounds like you did, whether this was objective, fair, and reasonable?
I did, and I think, though, I had to go with the precedents.
Okay.
So under that standard, I think it was fair in the sense that it's applied to inmates the same way. All inmates are applied the standard.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further? Great. I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Farish?
No.
Commissioner Fusick?
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. We didn't even have a motion.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. We need a motion.
This is Commissioner Sherry. I'll move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Commissioner Hackett, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? You jumped the gun. Here we go.
Well, getting back to discussion, I guess. I guess one of the overriding issues here, though, also is that he has a lawyer who was going to pay for this, and it sort of muddies the water, I think, a little bit in terms of our deciding against it. Yeah, I still think we should examine the issue, though. But I guess I tend to agree this may not be the right time to do it. But I think we all feel strongly, listening to the commission, that something should be done. So I'll continue to vote yes.
This is Commissioner Hankins.
Yes, Commissioner Hankins.
Yeah, just that, I mean, the complaint did appear at the hearing pro se, so his attorney was not going to appear here today. There's just been probably a miscommunication, but there's been no appearance filed, and the you know
the complainant, you know, appeared via telephone conference. So he was the attorney, and during the hearing, he said his attorney was going to pay. And I don't know, I they probably can pay during the, you know, some special public defender fund or something.
I'm looking again at paragraphs 11 and 12, yeah. Well, that's the reference to the lawyer.
Yeah. So, you know.
Yes, the hearing officer.
Yeah, Mary Kate Smith for the record. Just to clarify, my understanding was that, you know, there was a letter that the complainant had said, my attorney will pay for this. In response to that, and I think that the testimony was this as well, that they reached out and tried to find this attorney and couldn't locate him or contact him. So that's when they sent the letter to the complainant saying this is the amount. So there was an attempt by the respondents to try to reach out, work it out with the attorney, and that attorney hadn't, for whatever reason, they didn't connect.
Attorney Smith, if that attorney surfaced and came up with the $438, could they obtain those records at that time?
The attorney could have, but my understanding, based on the testimony of the record, there might be some exemptions that were mandatory.
So there still would be exemptions.
There might have been some redactions.
Some redactions, okay. Right. Yes.
But nothing preclude, you know, this
Commissioner Streeter.
Yeah, Commissioner Streeter, just by dismissing this does not preclude him from, or his attorney from, seeking these records again.
Right. Interesting.
That was going to kind of be my question. So even if we dismiss the case, if the attorney resurfaced, but if we dismiss the case, he can't file an appearance in a case that's no longer existing, right? So that's out. But should this attorney resurface and reach out to them, is there something that we could put in the order that would, because I don't think, it doesn't look like you got a chance to really get into it, but I don't see that there's an issue that he's entitled to the records based off the request itself. There may be some exemptions in that regard, but the face of the request itself, he would be entitled to the record. So is there something that could be added in the decision that would say nothing would preclude the attorney from that, you know, based on your findings in paragraph 11 and 12, to paying for the records and the respondent receiving them, or the claimant receiving them in return?
So based on the face of the request itself, it does, you know, and I found that they've was a request for public records, but because they're police records, I asked this at the hearing, the respondents did say that there would be some exemptions, so some redactions. So the answer would be is entitled to, except for some potentially mandatory exemptions. So we would have to take that into account, but principally, there is nothing that bars the complainant's attorney from requesting these records and paying for them. And then if there are some redactions, can file a complaint with the commission. If the complainant disagrees with those redactions.
Anything further from any of the commissioners?
I would just say,
Commissioner Fusashi. Yeah.
I will vote to for Ms. Portfield. But I think too interesting is this issue of this, how does indigency work and these numbers work, and what does it mean that it's fair, and what's our ability to interpret that word fair?
Mm-hmm.
Is an interesting issue I've heard, and I would hope I'm at least taking away that we're going to keep an eye on that issue. And secondly, I'm interested a little bit procedurally. What happens when a person who's a prisoner for a particular, just as a conceptual thing that I'm taking away from this, says I haven't represented by an attorney, and then the case moves forward, but we never have contact with the attorney. Is there a way through the, I know each of our prisons has a FOIC advocate, or FI, to communicate that the prisoner thinks he's represented by an attorney, we're getting up, that's sort of a, because we always like, I always like to be particularly cognizant when somebody says I'm represented by attorney, but the attorney's not here. Let's say I'm pro se. And so that's a second issue, just mechanically, that has emerged here in my mind as an interesting issue to keep a procedural eye on. Maybe you guys do.
Well, we have a robust mediation program where I would assume that would potentially come up there, and that our
mediator would, you know, probably try to assist with that if that had been communicated. I don't think in this case that was communicated until now.
Right, no.
But
I don't want to take too many, but thank you. I don't want to take too many, but I think that's an interesting.
That would probably come up.
Learn more before we hit the next case like that. Thank you. Council.
Just for the record, Mary Kate Smith, yes. At the hearing, the complainant didn't say, I'm representing, my attorney should be here. He did go forward with the hearing, so just for the.
That's good clarification. I mean, important clarification. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't mean to take too much time.
Good job. Thank you. Is there anything further from any of the commissioners? All right, so the motion's been made and seconded. There's no further discussion. We'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn.
Yes.
Mr. Farish.
Yes.
Commissioner Fusashi.
Yes.
Mr. Goolsbee.
Yes.
Mr. Ganswin.
Yes.
Mr. Hankins.
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter.
Yes.
And myself, yes. Passes unanimously. With the understanding that we're going to look at this issue going forward. Thank you. I don't know. Mr. Myers, are you still there?
Yeah.
I think you are. Okay. All right, so the next matter is docket number FIC 2023-0188, Faith Murray versus Comptroller, State of Connecticut, Office of the State Comptroller. Will the parties please identify themselves for the record, starting with you, ma'am?
Faith Murray.
Thank you.
Ben Abrams, Assistant Attorney General.
Thank you. Please grab a seat. Before we begin, I think there's one Scrivener's error that Mr. Streeter would like to address.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Streeter, on page 21 in the paragraph 57, there's a parenthesis that references the note below, and it should say see note 11 below, not note 11. So I think it's just a Scrivener's error. I don't think we need to quote on it. Just, it was a typo. It should have been 12 instead of 11.
Just for the record, Attorney Harmon, thank you, Commissioner. It's right. It should say paragraph 12. Thank you.
Page 21.
Here?
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a high standard for reading.
I cheated. She told me.
Parties have identified themselves.
Try to meet that standard. Don't guarantee it, but I'm nicely done.
Yeah, parties have identified themselves. Ms. Murray, would you like to begin, please?
Good afternoon. I respect the decision from hearing Officer Attorney Harmon. I do not agree that state agencies can continue to cash in and hide behind on a decades-old FOI ruling that state job applications continue to constitute as examinations. By allowing this decision to remain, State of Connecticut agencies, such as the Office of the State Comptrollers, will continue to hire not the best, not the brightest, not the most skilled, or even the most qualified candidates, but rather continue favoritism and cronyism within the state. By allowing this decision to remain, State of Connecticut agencies will continue to promote a toxic culture and a hostile work environment. The hiring process begins with Department of Administrative Services, DAS, and once the applications passes the minimum qualifications, the applications are forwarded to the hiring agency. The agency itself is where the unscrupulous process of picking and choosing who to interview begins. As of October 30th, 2017, DAS, unions, and state agencies have put in writing, all of which I submitted at my hearing, stated that both the job application form and the old exam process were permanently eliminated and replaced with an entirely new state-of-the-art job application and recruitment process that has been thoroughly modernized when DAS launched its new job app software program. To reiterate DAS, quote, jobs can be found and applied for online, and the evaluation of the application filed and whether it meets the minimum qualifications of the job will now constitute the examination. Department of Correction and State Police are the only agencies that will continue to offer exams and maintain exam lists for positions for certain job classes. Unquote. In docket number FIC 2015-109, Barry Natal against Commissioner, State of Connecticut, Department of Education, and State of Connecticut Department of Education, number 15. It is found that the same form, CT HR 12, is used in the state's classified service as an examination application and also as an employment application. The key to determining whether a completed CT HR 12 form is an application for examination or employment is whether the position at issue is classified by the Department of Administrative Services as competitive or non-competitive. Because non-competitive positions do not require examinations, the completed CT HR 12 forms for such positions are employment applications. Number 20. Because the completed CT HR 12 form submitted by general trades workers were not used to determine a final earned rating in a merit examination, it is concluded that the completed CT HR 12 form at issue in this case were employment applications, not examination applications. The completed CT HR 12 form at issue in this case are therefore not subject to 5-225 GS. Or exempt pursuant to 1-210B6 GS. Therefore, the respondents violated 1-210A and 1-212A GS by withholding such records from the complainant. And number 21, the commission notes that the fact that the same form, CT HR 12, is used as both an examination application and also as an employment application creates some potential for confusion concerning the applicability of 5-225 GS. The completed form may be subject to exemption or mandatory disclosure, depending on its use in individual cases. However, the employment application cases are outside the context of 5-225 GS, which in contrast to employment application includes examinations with final earned ratings subject to appeal and correction. Both the law and the public policy in favor of disclosure are particularly compelling in cases where completed form CT-HR-12 is an employment application. Employment applications for non-competitive positions should be subject to mandatory disclosure. I submitted several exhibits, including job postings, announcements, emails, and newsletters demonstrating exams are only offered at the agencies of Department of Corrections and the Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection. This is a significant change in the old application and examination process, as this now creates no division between competitive and non-competitive positions. Non-competitive and competitive application process and the state of Connecticut job application process has changed, and a new FOI declaratory ruling should follow. Thank you for allowing me the time to speak, as I will continue to believe in the process.
Thank you, Ms. Murray, for the remarks. I think that the officer's report is very thorough. If you read it, it encompassed 120 requests. There were 9,000 pages that were produced to the complainant. 160,000 documents or pages of records were reviewed by the agency, and there was only a few that were subject to the exemption. I think I'll just concentrate on the personnel record that Ms. Murray is referring to. The legislature has, I think, found it important, creating this exemption, that state agencies are able to assess and rate their candidates in a frank manner, and this commission and FOI in general is bound by what the legislator has prescribed. The decisions of the Go John versus commissioner and Casala versus commissioner are both on point. And the hearing officer in this case did a very careful in-camera inspection of all the records submitted, found that they were positions, competitive positions in the classified service, and therefore are exempt under 1-210B6. And I ask that the commission adopt the report.
Thank you. Do any of the commissioners have any questions?
Commissioner Hankins, it just seems to basically be an argument as to whether or not the specific provision exempting documents is correct. And again, we don't go into the wisdom of the legislature. You know, we don't substitute our legislative judgment for that of the legislature. So I don't think there's much here to be argued about.
Thank you. Any of the other commissioners have any questions or comments? Is the hearing officer available?
Do you have any questions for me, or do you want me to just generally?
I wanted you to just generally comment, please.
So, for the record, Attorney Alicia Harmon, I was the hearing officer in this case. I just want to just first start with the fact that this was a 120-part request for records. It was very, you know, very big. Even if we look at the first request in priority one list, it went from January 1st, 2019, all the way through February 3rd, 2023, the day of the request. That's number one. So this was a huge undertaking for the respondents. Secondly, they submitted 397 pages of in-camera records. It is the first time in my history with this commission, which spans more than 17 years, that a submission of in-camera records over 35 pages has been spot on. I just want to put that out there. It was a meticulous in-camera production. You know, what a state with regard to the B6 determination on page 19, you know, what a state agency says on its website about what an application is going to be does not change what the law says. We have a clear case law that we've recognized in paragraph 52 that employment examinations don't necessarily have to be in the form of a formal test. You know, an evaluation of credentials, experience, and evaluation will be considered test material under the law, regardless of what any individual agency is going to say on its website. I can say that I had general counsel under oath here for two very long, extensive hearings. And I know, because I listened to that tape, that the testimony was that these were competitive positions and that when I looked at the actual information in the in-camera submission, it was really spot on to what we say is exempt under 1-210B6. And also, you know, one Connecticut General Statute 5-225 would provide another basis upon which it would be exempt. So I think that this was an extraordinary undertaking. I think the respondents did, like, it's almost unbelievable that they were able to do what they did. So I really don't have anything else to say.
How many records were produced?
I think it was over 9,000. The problem was the potentially responsive records. I think there were 180,000 records. I might be wrong on that, but I think I might be right. They had to sift through all of those records to get down to those 9,000. And then I had 397 in camera, which were redacted to varying degrees, some of which just had like the most minimal appropriate redactions that I could. I mean, it was very impressive in camera submission. Like I said, I've never seen one like that before. So,
how many of those in camera records did you allow?
The in-camera submission, what was redacted from those records was correct under the law.
On all 390?
All of them.
397 pages?
All of the redactions were completely tailored to the information that was exempt. Okay. That's the surprising part.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from commissioners?
May I speak?
Excuse me, are there any other questions from any of the commissioners?
This is Commissioner Hankins. It says in paragraph 57 that the respondent spent over 380 hours looking at this. I don't know if that was...
That was general counsel, okay. Attorney Harmon, for the record. That was general counsel's time only.
So that is a lot more by other people then.
There were other employee hours involved.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the commissioners? Yes, ma'am.
Dave Murray, I just want to say that many of the records that I received were in were like 10 of the same documents over and over and over again. So I didn't receive those documents as one. I received them 10, 12 times. They were just the same thing over and over for all those pages. And what I am, I accept Attorney Harmon's decision. The only part I was disagreeing with was the fact that I was asking for applications. And since the job application has changed and the rulings were always based off of CTHR 12s and the previous document before that, we no longer have that as a state of Connecticut process. We have a different process. It doesn't, an application is an examination. You do not get a score. You're not on an exam list. But Department of Corrections and State Police, they continue that process. It's still the old process. I'm stating I agree with the decision, except for the application process where they're not disclosed, where we can't see the fundamentals of someone applying for a job or whether that they were appropriately the qualified candidate. And the competitive and non-competitive, if you saw job postings, they're the exact same now. And that's my argument here, or where I disagree. It's just the applications, not everything. Everything I receive, I accept.
Counsel? Nothing further. Yes, Commissioner Streeter.
Yeah, Commissioner Streeter, just in response to the complaint, I'll see this number of times when there's like a request that's either voluminous or that, like even your priority one, number one, where you list a lot of people. Those records will be in each of these people's little, communication. So when we have these large things, we see it a lot of times where the complaint will say, well, I got the same document multiple times. Well, that's what happens when you request a certain information and it's amongst a whole group of people, especially in your case, it was 120.
However, number one was just eliminated.
So I'm just letting you know that, you know, we see this all the time. So it's the fact that you're getting multiple records, that you're asking for multiple records.
Thank you. Any other commissioners have anything to say? All right. And
entertain. May I speak?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead. Chief
Murray, question number one was only adopted for one name. It was eliminated completely. So the volumes of redundant records were not based on more than one name. It was on one name.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Any and all communications to or from any party, internal or external, regarding and or mentioning Faith Murray from January 1st, 2019 up to present, up to including in the list 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and any OCS employee, any DAS employee, any OPM employee, an OLR employee, and any others not specifically listed. That sounds to me very broad.
Is there any further nominee questions? All right, I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the hearing.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Mr. Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Farish?
Yes.
Mr. Fusashi?
Yes.
Mr. Goldsby?
Yes.
Mr. Gansman?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, all in Aiden, yes. Passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. All right. We know we have one recusal on the next matter. Docket number FIC 2023-0197, Stephen Nevis versus Executive Director of Westport Library Association et al. So,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. I need to recuse myself because I serve on the board of a nonprofit with Attorney Nevis.
Okay, so we'll come get you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can the parties please identify themselves, starting with the complainant?
Yes, for the complaint, I am the complainant, Stephen Nevis. I am an attorney.
Thank you.
Heather Spade from the law firm Lena Zabel and Schellenberg here representing the respondents, the Westport Library Association, and its executive director.
Thank you. Attorney Nevis, would you like to begin?
Yes, thank you. I requested additional time, but I will try not to use it.
Okay. We'll address that if we get to that issue. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, For context, I represent and brought this in support of the estate of Marion Grebo Olson, who was a ceramic artist with an international reputation. Her husband, Gustav Olson, is here with me today. We requested documents from the Westport Public Library in connection with a 28-foot-long, 8-foot-high ceramic mural, which depicted the history of the town of Westport that Mrs. Olson created for the library to commemorate the history of the city, and at the time to raise in excess of $300,000 for the reconstruction of the library. The mural was installed and then removed during reconstruction. The library had committed itself to returning it, but then refused to do so. And that is the situation we are now facing, and we are seeking records to try to understand what occurred. As to the substance of this case, we pointed out during the commission's fact-finding that the bylaws of the library require it to comply with at least part of the Freedom of Information Act, that which requires meetings to be open to the public. And by doing so, we ask you to find that the library has long since, because this provision has been there for a long time, waived its right to claim to be not subject to the act. We don't believe that the commission should put itself in a position or allow any entity to put itself in the position where a party is permitted to pick and choose which portions of the Freedom of Information Act it decides to comply with, as has happened in this case. It is also, we believe, of significance that this case resembles your decision in the Woodstock Academy case in a number of respects, more than any other case that has been reported and taken up on appeal. Like in the Woodstock case, Woodstock received most of its funds from the town, the library gets the lion's share of its operating budget, as much as 93% of it, from an appropriation from the town of Westport's taxpayers. Like in Woodstock, that provides a free public education, the library and its collection and events are open to the public free of charge. Like in Woodstock, there was no day-to-day supervision of the activities of the library. And like in Woodstock, which was created by a charter from the General Assembly, the library was created more than 100 years ago by a charter that was issued by the legislature. As we pointed out in our objection, which was filed with you, the commission is mandated and takes very seriously its obligation to maximize public access to the documents the government undertakes or produces on behalf of its citizens. But the proposed final decision takes, we believe, the narrowest and most restricted view possible of the library and its role in the Westport community. We cite and ask you to consider the advice of the Supreme Court, which it gave everyone in the Woodstock case, advice repeated in subsequent cases. And that advice is that a case-by-case application of the factors that it laid out for us in Woodstock should be paramount, so as not to formulate what the court called to ignore the functional realities of a particular situation. Woodstock laid out in the proposed final decision recognizes four factors to be used to decide if an activity or an entity is the functional equivalent of a public agency. And they are, and I'm sure you're familiar with them, whether the entity performs a government function. Second, what is the level of government funding? Third, the extent of government involvement or regulation. And finally, if the entity was created by government. You were to use a balancing test, according to the court, with no single factor to be determinative. We ask you to find that the library performs a public function. And I'd like to point out that there's no law or court decision that tells us with any certainty what is a public function. Because government, by the way it acts and spends its money, decides what's a public function. It's true that the operation of police forces, fire departments, and schools, as well as sanitation, public health, and parks, as the hearing officer has pointed out in his report, are public functions. But why not a tax-supported public library open to all comers? There is no reason why such a library is not also a public function. The proposed decision on this prong of the test asserts that government does not make day-to-day decisions for the library and therefore it's not a public function, but neither was that true in the Woodstock case. As we pointed out during fact-finding, when town government disagreed with the library's failure to turn over or share the proceeds from the sale of their old building that they sold when they moved to the new one, the town slashed the library's budget, which comes up annually for review and is not rubber stamped. So there is that part of oversight, and I'll come to more in a moment. Government decides what is a public function in many cases by how and much money it spends and why it spends it. And we point out state law, and we've done this in detail in the objection that we filed with you. State law recognizes funds and for public libraries and oversees and defines what is a public library, thereby adding to the view that the operation of a public library is a public function. That deals with the first prong of the Woodstock test. The second prong, we in the commission agree, it appears, that it is satisfied. Town government appropriates as much as 93% of the library's budget. The third prong requires us to look at the level of government involvement in the regulation or the regulation of the library, and we maintain that it is substantial. The amount of taxpayer money allocated to the library tells us a lot, but there's much more. The library is built on land owned by the town and has been leased to the library until the year 2089. That is an intense level of involvement all by itself. The town contributed millions to the reconstruction of the library, and it owns 23% of the building. The lease, building, ownership, and construction funding make the town's involvement quite inextricable. But there's more. By law, the town charter gives the representative town meeting, which is the legislative body of Westport, the right to choose and seat 10, which is half of the membership of the library's board of trustees. The RTM has done that for many years, more than I can count, and it continues to do so today. The respondents have tried to tell the commission that it controls the RTM selection process, which is what it has been trying to do in the last year or two. But the town has not agreed to let the respondents do that, and I have no information to believe that the town intends to let that happen. We respectfully ask the commission not to place itself, therefore, because of the requirement of the town charter, in the position of ratifying an attempt by the respondents to either subvert or violate the town charter. The fourth prong of the Woodstock test allows you to consider if the entity was created by government. And we believe there's no argument here that that is what occurred. One court attempted to minimize this factor when the entity was created by the legislature. But in this case, when the library got its charter in 1907, the General Assembly, which we should not assume issued charters blindly or recklessly, the library's role played a central role, and we believe that the legislature granted that charter because the library played a central role in the community. There was, back then, no radio or television, so the printed word dominated the information ecosystem. And if you could not afford or preferred not to buy newspapers, periodicals, and books, they were free at the public library, the Westport Public Library, thereby fulfilling, as the library does today in those and other ways, a central role in the health of our democracy. The founders of our country knew that the health of the democracy depended on having an informed public. The library played a central role in fulfilling that need and continues to do so today. And for those reasons, we ask you to find that the Westport Public Library is the functional equivalent of a public agency. I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Attorney Nevis.
10 minutes, Attorney Nevis. That was impressive. 10 minutes, you did it.
All right. So, Attorney Spade.
Thank you. In advance of today's meeting, the library submitted to the commission its post-hearing memorandum of law and also reply brief, which were both filed after the contested case hearing in this matter, for a detailed explanation and recitation of the library's position that it is not subject to FOIA. I refer you to those briefs, which set forth the factual and evidentiary record that was established at the hearing, most of which was established by evidence presented by the library, including through its 4 witnesses who offered testimony and through its approximately 15 documents entered into evidence, most of which were undisputed by the complainant in this matter. So the briefs set forward the factual and evidentiary record established at the hearing, as well as the legal framework and analysis required by Connecticut appellate law, Supreme and appellate court cases, determining, which set forth how to determine whether an entity is the functional equivalent of a public agency under the Act. With respect to the proposed finding and decision by hearing officer Kevin Munn, the library's position is that proposed decision is a thoughtful, a detailed, and reasoned analysis, which takes into account the evidentiary record that was established at the hearing, as well as the controlling legal authority governing the determination of whether the library is to be considered the functional equivalent of a public agency, which it is not, and we believe was correctly decided that it was not. The library's position is that the proposed finding and decision by hearing officer Munn should be approved and adopted by the commission today. Complainants' arguments in opposition to the proposed finding and decision have no foundation in the evidentiary record and no basis in the law. And I will just point out several things that were just stated by Attorney Nevis that were not presented at the hearing. And as we all know, the hearing is the only opportunity for parties to present testimony or documentary evidence in support of their position. Attorney Nevis presented no witnesses at the hearing and only 3 documents, which totaled approximately 5 pages in length. And as I said, the majority of the library's evidence was undisputed by Attorney Nevis at the hearing. So I will point out the statement that Attorney Nevis made relating to the town slashing the library's budget in response to, you know, something the town didn't agree to is nowhere in the evidence. I will point out that his assertion that the town has not agreed to the process by which trustees are appointed is nowhere in the evidence. And this argument that the library is somehow attempting to subvert or violate the town charter by seizing control from the RTM in its unapproved trustee appointment process was in fact raised by the complainant for the first time in the appeal that he filed last week in advance of this meeting. None of those things should be considered by this commission. Nor should complainant's assertion as to his belief as to why the General Assembly granted a charter to the library in 1907. Again, there is no, he presented no evidence about that at the hearing. Rather, complainant's arguments should be rejected as unsubstantiated in the record. As set forth in detail, and as Attorney Nevis just mentioned, the Connecticut Supreme Court, in the case of the trustees of the Woodstock Academy versus the Freedom of Information Commission, did in fact establish a 4-factor test for determining whether an entity is the functional equivalent of a public agency. Then, through subsequent Supreme and appellate, Supreme Court and appellate court decisions, each of those four factors was further defined and clarified. The proposed finding and decision accurately apply all of the law that is relevant to this determination. While the Woodstock factors themselves are acknowledged by complainant, he has not acknowledged a single factor in his briefing or otherwise, including here today in this in his argument, as to how each of those factors is applied. For example, today he made an argument that the library performs a government function. I believe he said there's no authority that says what this means. That's actually not true. So several appellate level decisions address the prong of what is considered to be meeting the prong of government function. So those decisions establish that this prong is not met where the entity was not required by statute to provide the government function at issue. I would just point out that in the Woodstock decision to which he referred, the entity at issue there was actually required by statute to provide a free public education to the citizens of Woodstock, which is why they were found to meet that factor. It's very different. The situation with the library is very different. This factor is simply not met. That was gone over in great detail in the briefs and also appropriately addressed in the proposed finding and decision. Complainants' arguments on this factor don't refer at all to the cases in Fire Test Systems, Connecticut Humane Society, or Domestic Violence Services of Greater New Haven, all of which set forth greater detail and contours around which this factor is determined. Another example, the third prong of the Woodstock test examines the government involvement in the regulation over the entity, or regulation over the entity. Again, the subsequent case law makes clear that this prong is only met when the entity operates under direct, pervasive, or continuous regulatory control or day-to-day supervision by the government. Again, that prong is not met here. That's established in detail in the library's briefs, and it's also addressed in the proposed decision, finding and decision. And complainants' arguments on this point make no reference to the appellate case law that controls this determination. Furthermore, the argument advanced by complainant that the library apparently opted in to coverage of, you know, the Freedom of Information Act, and it has subsequently waived its right to object to the application of the act over, you know, over the library and its affairs has absolutely no basis in the law whatsoever. Statutes, the Freedom of Information Act and Connecticut General Statutes provide what is covered, and if you qualify as a public agency or an implementing agency or the functional equivalent of a public agency, then you are covered by the act. If you do not, there's no such thing as I voluntarily am now going to be subject to the act and be held accountable by the commission. It just isn't, there's no authority for that proposition. And furthermore, his argument was addressed in the library's reply brief, and I can direct you all to the page. I believe it's page 5, and specifically addressing the notion that adopting a procedure, essentially a procedural element of FOIA voluntarily through its bylaws. Page 5, the paragraph starting, finally, complainant's assertion that the library acknowledges it is subject to FOIA is untrue and misstates the evidence in the record. Attorney Jocelyn Barandiaran specifically testified to the fact that the library has never considered itself to be subject to FOIA and further testified that section 6.8 the library's bylaws reflect the library's voluntary election at its own discretion to use the act as a guide for how to run meetings. And you can read the rest of that paragraph, but that, I believe, addresses the argument raised by the complainant. I would also just point out that the proposed decision cites on page 5 the Desmond case for the proposition that the functional equivalency test ensures the general rule of disclosure underlying the FOIA Act is not undermined by nominal appellations which obscure functional realities, while also ensuring that a truly private entity would not be subject to disclosures which were unintended by our Act. The library, as has been demonstrated by the evidence, and we believe correctly held by the hearing officer, is a truly private entity. It is not subject to the Act. And the library submits that the proposed finding and decision should be adopted.
If I may reply, but at some point, please.
Sure.
Council, can you explain to me why Horvath doesn't apply specifically to the Westport Library Association? Does it mention Woodstone? I don't have a copy here. Does it specifically mention Woodstone?
No. So the Horvath decision is approximately 20 years old. I don't have it in front of me, but it is. It's a 14th Amendment decision. Right. We also addressed the Horvath decision in our brief. I believe it's our initial brief, but just I can answer your question very quickly. The analysis required for the issue in that case was 14th Amendment, which there's no mention of the Freedom of Information Act in that case. The standards applied are different, and the Woodstock analysis is what applies to this question, and that had no application or even relevance or involvement with the Horvath decision. And for more, I can refer you to the page number in the library's post-hearing brief, which addresses the Horvath decision. Which is page 15.
I don't mean to be difficult. Can you give me a little more specific summary about why Horvath doesn't apply?
Is it okay if I just read the Horvath decision did not involve a claim under the Freedom of Information Act and is not applicable to, nor did the Horvath court undertake the Woodstock analysis. It would be clear error for the commission to permit a factual finding in this case for which the record of evidence presented is not available to the parties for inspection or consideration to supplant the clear factual record established by the library at the hearing in this matter. The Horvath decision centers around 14th Amendment due process concerns in connection with a claimed violation of 42 United States Code Section 1983. The applicable legal standard in Horvath is different than the legal standard applicable to the analysis of whether an entity is the functional equivalent of a public agency under Connecticut's Freedom of Information Act. And the factual recitation and analysis in the Horvath decision strongly suggests that the evidence before the court in Horvath 20 years ago is significantly different than the evidence presented to the commission at the hearing in this matter.
That's what I'm looking for. Specifically, why isn't the finding that the Westport Library Association is a state actor for the purposes of the 14th Amendment not sufficient to essentially overrule Woodstock? I mean, Woodstock was earlier. This is the Second Circuit, of course.
Right.
I mean, you have to concede that if someone claimed in an injury case, a discrimination case, a bias case, CHRO case, that the library would be subject to the 14th Amendment. So, I mean, the Second Circuit's already decided that. So why is the fact that an earlier state court case, Woodstock, which seemed to set forth standards, at least for the purpose of FOI, essentially doesn't overrule Woodstock?
Specifically,
as to the Westport Library.
Right. And it's an interesting question, and I think the answer to that question is in the fact that the factors considered by the court in Horvath are different than the factors considered and necessarily considered in the Woodstock analysis. So it's a little bit like, you know, an apples to oranges comparison. And I understand that there may end up being some kind of, you know, confusion in the, you know, in status at some point in the future. However, the fact of the matter is that if you have one set of factors that are relevant to a particular analysis, if for Horvath, right, how that case came out depends specifically on those factors. How this case comes out depends specifically on the Woodstock factors and on the Connecticut Supreme and Appellate Court decisions, which, you know, define and clarify each of those factors, which again are different than what was applied in Horvath. So I don't think that you can just superimpose the Horvath decision on to this, the Woodstock analysis, because it doesn't, it just doesn't fit.
Another note, didn't we have an American Cemetery Association case years ago involving a similar?
Yeah, I do, Mr. Heidman.
And it was not.
It was after Woodstock, right? And,
right.
And that went on appeal, didn't it?
Right, and it was not functional.
It was found not, yeah. Right. I remember that, yeah.
Right.
Sorry.
Anything further, Commissioner Heidman?
No, thank you.
Mr. Streeter.
Yes, Commissioner Streeter. I think that, you know, the hearing officer's report is well reasoned, and, you know, he went into great detail as far as the four prongs, and that only one of the four prongs was really applicable. So I want to commend the hearing officer on a well reasoned case. I do ask it that if the complainant does have rebuttal, that if, you know, the hearing officer can let us know if it's what he's bringing up is actually was in the record. As was made known by the respondent, I don't want to go off on a tangent to be discussing things that were not on the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Do any of the other commissioners have any questions, comments? Attorney Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just responding to Commissioner Einhorn, the distinction between Horvath in this case. So Horvath really was interpreting the 14th Amendment / Section 1983 under the Connecticut Code, where the Woodstock case is interpreting a state statute. So they're really two different issues. But really to get to the, I think your question is, what is the standard that Horvath implied? Because really that's, you know, that's why it's distinguishable. So the three factors, to determine that the Horvath court applied to determine whether the corporate entity qualifies as a state actor, which is the term that's used under the 14th Amendment. And this is the quote from the case. It's, if the government created the corporate entity by special law, the government created the entity to further governmental objectives, and the government retains permanent authority to appoint a majority of the directors of the corporation. So, some of those factors, you can see they shade into the Woodstock analysis, but they're, and I think that the two that really stood out to me is, one, the government created the entity to further governmental objectives. Horvath goes on to describe what that means, and it's whether the entity performs what's a legitimate statutory objective, where here, the way that the courts have expanded on, explained what's a governmental function under the Woodstock test, it's a much higher bar. So if the test was whether the public library is a legitimate government objective, I think clearly it is. But that's not the test that the Connecticut courts have applied in applying the government function prong of the Woodstock test. It's really whether the entity is required to perform the function. And if you look at all the cases, every court case where a court has found that something is a government function, it's where it's a service or a function that the government is required to provide to the citizens. And here, towns are permitted to have libraries and fund libraries, but they're not required to. So that's really the key distinction, I think, between those two factors. The other one in Horvath, the first factor was if the government created the corporate entity by special law. So one of the factors is whether the government under Woodstock is whether the government created the entity. But the cases go on to explain there's a 1991 Connecticut Supreme Court case involving Connecticut Humane Society that said Because 1800s and early 1900s, the private corporations often were chartered by the government. Just the fact that the government, that the entity has a government charter from the time when most corporations had government charters, like that alone is not enough to meet that test. And so you really have to look at sort of the details of what's in the charter, you know, what the entity was required to do, what involvement the town had. So it's really not just the fact alone, like, as I said, under Horvath, just the fact alone that the government created the entity, that satisfies that prong, where under Woodstock, that's not the case. So I think that's the really distinction between Horvath in this case. I think that was the main point I had to respond to. I don't know if there's any other specific questions that any of the other commissioners had, or if you wanted me to respond generally to anything else.
Can you just summarize the decision with regard to each of the prongs?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So, I'll start with whether the library performs a government function. As I mentioned, all of the court cases where the courts have found that something was a government function, it was something that the government was required to do. So, provide public education, provide, in the Greenwich Emergency Medical Services case, the municipalities are required to provide emergency medical services. Under the EnviroTest case, the state is required to have emissions testing program. So, you know, all things that the government is required to do, where here, the library, again, municipalities are authorized to have municipal libraries, they're authorized to fund, you know, private libraries, but they're not required to do that by statute. So that was the deciding factor in that case. But also, I think what I didn't mention before is the courts have also said that even if something is a government function, that prong of the test still isn't satisfied unless, so there's really three things. If entity is performing the service pursuant to contract, which that doesn't apply here, but really it says that the entity has to have the power to govern or to regulate or make decisions that affect the government. And the government has to be really involved in the core of the program. And testimony in this case overwhelmingly established that the town of Westport is not involved in the core of the program. The library decides what is in the collections, what services to provide, what events to hold. Really, testimony was that the town really, as far as the day-to-day operations of the library, the town is really hands-off. And so, really, for those two reasons, that government function prong was not satisfied. Level of government funding, I found that that prong was satisfied. The town provides, you know, 80 to 90% of the library's funding. I think all the cases have been decided before that this fits within the range of what would satisfy that prong. The extent of a government of involvement or regulation. The key to this prong is that the entity must operate under direct, pervasive, or continuous regulatory control. And the government has to control the day-to-day activities of the business, which again, that's not the testimony that was presented in this case. There really was no evidence at all that the town of Westport gets into the granular details of how the library functions. And whether the library was created by government, again, it was incorporated by the General Assembly, but the Humane Society case that the Supreme Court decided said that, again, just because there's a government charter doesn't mean that that prong is satisfied, especially at a time when the majority of corporations were chartered by government. So really, for that prong, I really looked at you know, what was in the charter and the circumstances surrounding when the library was created. So initially, it was formed as a private entity before the charter. The Westport Library was a private organization established by a group of private citizens. Those citizens sought a government charter. They obtained funding from the town. and they did get a government charter, but it was those citizens in the testimony that was presented said that those citizens went and they sought the government charter. If you read the charter, it says, you know, confirms that that's what happened. Nothing in the charter suggests that the library was intended to be anything other than a private, non-stock corporation. Who's given the power to self-govern. The town was given the right to appoint, in the charter, the town has the right to appoint less than a majority of the board. Under the bylaws, the library has given the town the right to appoint half of the board, but that's not in the charter, so they're not required to do that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Do any of the other commissioners have any questions, comments? Attorney Navis, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, just a couple of comments. The bylaws of the library, which were amended and restated effective July 1, 2019, at section 6.8, with respect to conduct of meetings, it specifically adopts section 1-100 subparagraph 6 of the Freedom of Information Act. This is an embrace. You are required. The library has bound itself to comply with the Freedom of Information Act with respect to its meetings. And by doing so, I believe it has exercised a recognition that it is subject to the law. Now, once you make that recognition, how do you take it back? For some parts of other parts of the law, which you'd rather not comply with. I think that's the problem that is presented here. And I don't think the commission should or would want to be in the habit of allowing people who come before you to cherry pick the parts of the law that they would like to comply with and those that they find inconvenient.
Can you hold off?
Sure.
Therese Spade, how do you respond to that?
I would say that the library's position on that would be that we would agree if you're talking about a public agency, the functional equivalent of a public agency or an implementing agency, that those such agencies, which are clearly under the statute subject to the Freedom of Information Act and the disclosure requirements of the Act, that those agencies cannot cherry pick which portions of the law they choose to require or they choose to comply with. However, when you're dealing with a private organization, there's no obligation to comply with any part of the Freedom of Information Act. An organization, in this case, the Westport Library Association, which is a private, non-stock Connecticut corporation, which has been granted 501c3 status by the IRS, which all of the evidence has, you know, established is not the functional equivalent of a public agency. It is just not subject to the Act, period. And whether the library, through its board, which governs, you know, which it governs, implements the bylaws and governs the library, whether they decide to adopt, for instance, Robert Rules of Order, or, you know, some procedure set forth in any act in the state of Connecticut or even any federal act, that's up to them. It's completely voluntary. The board of the bylaws of the library make it very clear, and this is all in evidence, make it very clear that the board itself can amend the bylaws at any time with the requisite number of votes, which I think is 2/3, but I can't remember exactly. The trustees have total authority over how they conduct the meetings and how they conduct their business. And in this case, they voluntarily elected to use that as a procedural mechanism for its meetings. That does not mean that they believed they were subject to the Act. They did not. They do not. They maintain that they are not subject to the Act. And I believe that the hearing officer correctly found that the library is not subject to the Act. And therefore, it does not matter if they voluntarily decide to follow, you know, the Freedom of Information Act's requirements for the conduct of a meeting, you know, or Robert's Rules of Orders or any other procedural mechanism that they elect to follow. it doesn't matter. They're not voluntarily saying, okay, now we are therefore subject to the Freedom of Information Act and all of its requirements. That's absolutely not what happened. And I don't think there's any basis in the law to impose that on the library as a private entity.
Commissioner Hankins, I wrote down Robert's Rules of Order also. You know, you can't opt in, you know, just by adopting, it's a procedural mechanism. I think they're using the FOI as a procedural mechanism. And you can't opt into being a government agency if you're not one. You know, you can't just join up. It's not a club. You know, you have to be one.
Thank you. Attorney Nevis, did you want to continue, please?
And I would like to point out in response that the library has not amended it, and this provision remains in effect today. And these bylaws are a matter of public record. So therefore, any member of the public who has an interest in this matter can look at this and see that the library has declared that it complies with the Freedom of Information Act, at least in part. A couple of other points I'd like to make. Record and evidence to the effect that the town meeting slashed the library's budget when the library sold its old building and did not report or share the proceeds with town government at a time when the town government was giving the library nearly $6 million a year. That is in the record and was included with a memorandum of law that we provided. The fact that there is no evidence to the effect that the RTM and its library committee have agreed to what the library has attempted to do with the selection process. There's no evidence. So therefore, there's no evidence to the effect that there's no evidence. And I just wanted to reply to that. Finally, with respect to what is a mandatory function, I'm not sure that a mandatory function of government fully explains what a functional equivalent of a public agency does. For example, if town government, as it has, appropriates $6 million to the public library, it expects and requests and will require that that money be applied to operate the public library as the library has represented to the town meeting it will do. Therefore, the library has assumed a responsibility to carry out an obligation to town government. So, limiting ourselves to the cases that have previously been decided, and both all of the court decisions that have dealt with this have pointed out that their decisions do not limit the scope and purview of what is the equivalent of a public agency. This is essentially a new case, one that has never, this set of facts or one like it, to our knowledge, has never been presented before. And we ask you not to dismiss this, but to see that this new set of facts presents a new opportunity, and a compelling one, we believe, to declare that the library is, in fact, the functional equivalent of a public agency.
And the new set of facts is the fact that the town put so much money into it, it then became a public agency?
Well, I think, in a sense, it has, because now the town and the library are locked together. Not only has the town spent millions of dollars on the construction of the library, but in the process acquired an ownership in the library.
That's why I asked about the cemetery case. Wasn't that a similar issue when we lost on that? I think Meriden not only owned the land, but just budgeted for it every year. And I think
so. I don't remember the exact facts, but there was compelling like that, yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure this is a new, in that regard, this is a brand new argument. That's the only reason I raised it.
Well, I think I was just suggesting that the overall fact pattern is.
This is Commissioner Hankins. That's only, Attorney Munn recognized that, and that's only one out of four prongs. So that's 250 batting average?
Well, it's not just the money. It's the way that the town has intertwined itself with the library, and the library intertwined itself with the town. And there was, in fact, litigation about this. And I did not cite this, but there was litigation about the relationship, which was resolved in Superior Court more than 10 years ago. So the library owns the land. They've committed it. They signed a 99-year lease. It's not up till 2089 now. I mean, the library and the town are inextricably married here for a long period of time unless somebody wants out of it and seeks a divorce. They've committed themselves on paper legally to each other for a long period of time. And it's hard to believe that the library, that the town, having granted this lease to the library, will not continue to fund it and to oversee it. And one of the factors that I did not mention, but which was cited to the commission earlier, is that the town charter and ordinance provide for the library committee to study and review the operations of the library on a continuing basis. And that is a committee of the RTM, which has, therefore, has oversight over the library, because all of the nominations to the board and the budget for the library go through that committee. So there is, we believe, an inextricable relationship here between town government and the library that will continue for a long time.
Thank you, Attorney.
All right, thank you.
Anything through spin?
If I could just make a couple of points in response. One of the sort of themes of this matter has been the complainants continuing to offer new evidence after the hearing. I would submit that any reference to what you just referred to in terms of, you know, litigation between the library and the town, there's, you know, that the town oversees the library, that's actually contrary to all of the evidence in the record. And further, this idea that the Library, Museum, and Arts Committee of the Westport Representative Town Meeting is charged with studying and reviewing the library is, first of all, not in evidence. And second of all, it's not true. I actually looked this up. And so just, you know, to the extent, you know, that he offers it here, I just want to point out that it is not in evidence, and further, the representation is actually inaccurate. And I just also wanted to point out, with respect to the funding, the evidence clearly demonstrated that there's no requirement on the library with respect to how they use the funding received by the town. There's actually, you know, no requirement on the town to provide funding. There's no requirement on the library to seek its funding through the town. And we also established at the hearing that there's no restrictions on how the library uses the funding it receives from the town.
Attorney Martin.
Just because Commissioner Streeter asked me to note this, so the point about the library slashing the town's funding, that was mentioned in a post-hearing brief, but there was no testimony or other evidence presented. It was a statement made in a brief after the hearing. So it is in the record in the sense that it's in a brief, but there's no evidence to that effect. The point about the process of appointing the RTM appointed trustees, the executive, so there is no, the executive director did testify that this has been the process. There's been no deviation from this process, at least as far as he has been aware. There's never been an objection by the RTM to this process. So that's the extent of the evidence on that point. That's the process, and that's the RTM has gone along with that process as far as anyone who testified has been aware. My recollection is that there was no evidence about the litigation that was mentioned, although I'm just the first time I'm hearing of it today, so I can't be 100% sure that there's not something in this, but I don't have any recollection of that point. And then there was a significant testimony that the town has never attempted to exert control over the library. So the Library, Museum, and Arts Committee was brought up, was mentioned, but the testimony was that there has never been an attempt by, at least as far as any of the witnesses that testified were aware, by the RTM to exert that kind of detailed control over the day-to-day decisions of the library. I just wanted to, if I could just go back to the point about the bylaws and the adopting the FOI Act, I think, aside from the other points that were mentioned, I just think as a commission, we would want to encourage private entities to do that. If a private entity that receives government money makes a decision to have open meetings, I think that's a good thing. And for the commission to use that sort of against the private entity, I think would probably set a bad precedent. I think we want to encourage entities to be open and not give them a reason to shy away from it. So just as a practical point, I think that's something to consider as well.
Thank you. Do any of the other commissioners have discussion?
I just think, the point that it was just made is really critical. We have to look at it also from the perspective of the impact on the private participants in these kinds of arrangements of our decisions. I just have one question for you, Trina, because I'm really struggling with this. I love libraries, hang around libraries, go to libraries wherever they let me in. Not all of them let me in because some are public and some are quasi-public and some are private. And, I'm an admirer of Ben Franklin, great contributor, particularly in retrospect to the Constitution, and the founder of the Philadelphia Public Library, the first great library. But I'm struggling with this government function, government mandatory. I'll take away the word mandatory. Is everybody able to borrow books at the Westport Library? Yes. I live in Greenwich. Can I come and borrow books?
Yes, you can.
But same way as you live in Westport?
Yeah. If you have a Greenwich card, it's very easy. If you do not have a Greenwich library card, they'll work it out for you. But they're open to the public, and anyone and everyone can come and
can
borrow.
Come.
Yeah, and borrow.
And borrow.
Yeah.
So if I'm a kid from Bridgeport, I can come in and get a book from Westport Library?
Yeah, they might ask for a driver's license or some identification. But yeah, you can.
So it's totally open to the public.
Right. And Connecticut also has a very sophisticated interlibrary system.
I know. I said,
yeah.
I know
so the book, you
but
have a book that's
putting,
in Brookfield.
Take away the interlibrary, just
it. Right.
If I get run over by a car in Westport, the ambulance will come and pick me up and take me and find out where I live later. My car blows up in a fire. The fire. And the library will let me in this
place.
And the library will let me in the same way, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
It's new to me.
Yes.
If we go along with this thinking a little bit here, are towns mandatorily then supposed to provide libraries?
No, a town can elect to provide a library. Towns are not mandated to provide libraries, but when they do, they fall into a state regulatory scheme with respect to any funding that they want from the state. They have to comply with certain requirements, and there is state oversight.
So this is not a quasi-public-private partnership. It's something different. It's that's what I'm struggling with. How do I differentiate this from wanting to promote and make possible foundations and private donors, which I know is a core issue here, the beautiful sculpture that was and promised in perpetuity, I believe. But anyway, there was at one time and isn't. But
it's
I'm
now
struggling
cut
with
up
this,
in storage anyway.
Yeah, but whatever. I'm struggling with this balance and where the Westport Library decision would fall in that pushing these cases.
I think how it presents itself to the public is really what should determine our decision here. It really is the Westport Public Library, even though it calls itself the Westport Public Library Association. It's open to all. It invites all. It's books and periodicals and facilities and computer terminals, and recordings and DVDs and whatever else is in their collection is available to anyone who requests them, who presents the proper identification, free of charge.
So really what I'm struggling with is this word in the previous, as I understand it, analysis of this prong, is it mandatorily required service, or is it sufficient to be a truly public service where anybody who walks in that town or falls down in that town, is it then meet somehow the prong? And that's what I'm struggling with.
Right.
Because I wish in the heaven of heavens and world that public libraries would be truly public libraries. On the flip side, I'm struggling with what effect this has on future decisions on quasi-public-private partnerships where people and donors and people want to participate. They say, well, now, but I know that you crossed that border a little bit in Westport by allowing meetings to be public. It's not the full cross, but so, and people still want to serve on the board, obviously, and be part of the part. So that's balancing where this tilts it. Because I love libraries, and I want libraries to benefit from this decision, not be hurt by it.
I think that the way to describe it is that once a library that meets, that has these characteristics, opens itself to the public, intertwines itself with town government that it has, both by an appropriation without which it could not survive, and on land that it is committed to lease for 99 years, in a building that the they could not have built without public money, and holds itself open to the public at large because given its circumstances and funding and location has no other alternative. And not every private entity does that, certainly. Or gets that kind of public funding or sits on public land or leases that land or gets the municipality to help build their building. Once an entity does all of those things, I think they're inescapably the equivalent of a public agency. They've taken on the earmarks of public service of a public agency on public land open to all free of charge. They meet the definition of a public library in the state statute, which is you have to operate free of charge.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Any further comments or questions by the commissioners? All right. I entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Commissioner Hankins, second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? I want to say that these were excellent arguments made by both counsel. I really appreciate Attorney Martin's decision. It was a very thoughtful and excellent decision. I have concerns when 80 or 90% of the funding of government funds go to an agency that is considered private, but I understand that's the law. I think that people in their town, in the town and the state of Connecticut should know where the funds are going and what's happening, and it should be open to them, but that is not the law in this matter. I think you've applied the law accurately here, Attorney Martin, and I think you've done an excellent job doing so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. All right, is there any other comment? All right, with that, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Mr. Farish? Excuse me, she's recused. Commissioner Fuzeshi?
I'm going to vote yes, but with mixed emotions.
Commissioner Goolsbee?
Yes.
Mr. Gansman?
Yes.
Mr. Hankins?
Yes.
Mr. Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, only, and yes, passes unanimously with one abstention. All right, thank you very much, everyone. Great job. Great job, Attorney Martin. Thank you. We should take a 5-minute recess. I think it's going to link the. Oh, that's probably.